I'm Jamin Warren. There's so much that happened this year in video games. There were big movements in the world of virtual reality. There were releases of new consoles and new platforms, new seasons of popular video games, and not to mention esports. There was so much going on. And even though we have a podcast in our newsletter, unfortunately, we didn't have a chance to cover everything. So in this episode, we're looking back at the year in video games and also ahead to 2020. I invited someone whose job it is to keep up with video games. Sarah Needleman is a reporter at the Wall Street Journal who writes about video games, which, coincidentally, I used to do as well. So you and I crossed paths at the Wall Street Journal, but we never actually met. I mean, you have a stipple drawing. I don't have a stipple drawing, which is, that's the mark of a true Wall Street Journal person, is whether or not you have a stipple portrait of yourself.
Yeah, you usually get them if you write a column. So years ago, I wrote a column and I got one, and then it was updated more recently. And I can't remember the reason why I got the upgrade, but it was nice because I've changed my look over the years.
What do you think is your contribution kind of to the broader world of writing about video games? Like, what do you think makes a Sarah Needleman story? Or by extension, what do you think makes a Wall Street Journal story about games different from some of the things that you might find elsewhere?
Well, look, the Wall Street Journal is first and foremost a business publication. So I approach writing about the video game industry often from the business perspective, the companies that make games and how they generate revenue and turn a profit. But there is also a very big cultural aspect of gaming. It's, unlike some other businesses, it's, it's, first of all, it's a consumer interactive entertainment product. And so naturally, I enjoy it myself. So even if it wasn't my job, playing games is something that's fun. It's something just about everybody does. Even, people who are grandparents, they may not admit it, but they're playing Candy Crush sometimes. Or they grew up playing a video game. It really spans all ages. So I do look at it from that business lens, but I also keep in mind the cultural aspect of it. And I try to sort of blend the two as best as possible.
Yeah. Given, your perch at the Journal, kind of the 30,000 foot perch looking at the world of games, let's look backwards. I'm curious, what were some of the things that you felt like in this past year that really you feel like move the needle for the video game industry, or things that you were excited about? And we can talk about some of those.
Sure. I don't know if I would say I'm excited about them, but I noticed that this year was a real, the whole loot box scandal, if you want to call it that, really kicked into high gear. Like, it started, I think, really back in 2017 with the Star Wars Battlefront game that brought it up. But it's sort of escalated this year because a lot of politicians started waking up to the concept of loot boxes and putting out legislation, or proposing legislation, rather, to curb it. And then the World Health Organization officially made gaming a potentially diagnosable disorder. And so those two things coming together, I think, made it a tough year to some extent for the video game businesses to come across to consumers in a positive light, especially parents who are helping making the buying decisions for children. So that was a big one this year.
Right. I mean, I guess, to your point about, the Journal covering culture versus business, you kind of have two different points of skepticism around games. One is focused on the business model side of the equation, right? Because that's what drives, functionally, that's what drives these loot boxes, microtransactions. And on the other side, you have this cultural, kind of this cultural argument. Do you think that that's something that will continue in the upcoming year?
Yeah, I think as far as like specifically loot boxes themselves go, I think we're going to see less of them, or we'll still see them, but there won't be the kind where they give you some sort of competitive advantage. It'll just be cosmetic. And then I do think that will die down. But the broader issue surrounding loot boxes also ties to this concept of game addiction. And I don't think that's going to go away. And for young folks, it is hard, especially the peer pressure, because games are so social now. So you may be inclined to keep playing until you get that one item that all your friends have, or that for some reason you feel you need to have, because we all know kids want certain things. Just like if there's a rare pair of Nike sneakers in the real life, if there's a rare skin in Fortnite, to them to get it is something very important, and we have to keep that in mind.
Right. Well, one of the things I thought was interesting about this year was the launch of Apex Legends, you know, another multiplayer competitive shooter game. Last year was and continues to be really all about Fortnite. Fortnite continues to be one of the biggest games on the planet. But I do think the Apex Legends launch earlier this year was really interesting because it did at least momentarily kind of puncture a hole, you know, or at least open the door that something could be as big as, you know, as big as Fortnite. And also the way that launch was positioned, you know, they kind of targeted the biggest streamers on, you know, on some of the streaming platforms to really be the main advocates as opposed to, you know, cause one of those traditional kind of big tentpole pieces of advertising.
Well, definitely something to point out. It's definitely a noteworthy piece of history. What it showed to me is that the streamers, the influence they have on consumers is significant. That's why they're called influencers. It shows that they really do influence people in terms of the decisions they make. And so the other factor, though, let's keep in mind is that Apex Legends is free to play,
right.
Which is all just like Fortnite. And what made Fortnite so special, and it really does deserve credit in 2019, because even though it started getting the big momentum in 2018, it really carried its way through this year on the fact that it is free to play and very easy to learn in these short sessions. And so we learned a lot about gaming from behavior from Fortnite. And Apex Legend took some of the lessons from that and showed how to apply it to a new game. And I think also the fact that the Electronic Arts didn't promote it at all in advance. It just came out of nowhere. And they got the biggest streamer of all, Ninja.
Of course.
and so it was very smart on their behalf because people, especially in the gaming industry, at least in my observation, are very judgmental, and they have very strong opinions about the lead game companies. And their memories of past experiences that they didn't like for whatever reason, really, they tend to hold a grudge. And so when a company announces months and months ahead before a game comes out that it's coming, there's plenty of time for feelings to brew and people to make judgment calls and obsess over past mistakes and consider how this will apply to the new game. And with Apex Legends, Electronic Arts completely wiped out that possibility. There was no advance notice, so the critics couldn't puncture holes in it and find ways to complain or criticize past mistakes EA did. It just came out of nowhere, and then they had these very popular figures playing the game. And let's keep in mind, Ninja was free to some extent to say if he didn't like it. First of all, he wouldn't have taken the gig most likely if he didn't like it. They all had a chance to play the game a few days prior to the big launch day. So I would have to imagine that if it was really, really terrible and everybody hated it, EA would have pulled the plug and said no. So I think consumers and viewers or gamers, however you want to refer to them, watching saw that these guys were genuinely having a pretty good time playing it. It's hard to fake that. And so it was really impactful.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I do think one of the things that made Fortnite really successful, you know, in addition to being free, was, you know, this idea that you could actually play games on like multiple platforms, right?
And absolutely.
The fact that you could play with your friends and it didn't matter. I mean, there's so much in the culture of video games that's been about like pitting platforms against each other, you know, Nintendo versus Sega, and then, you know, Sony against Microsoft, and then Sony against Microsoft and Nintendo, then you have PC gaming, right, and they have its own identity. And so for the first time, the conversation has been about, you know, with Fortnite, you know, hey, look, it's less about like what system you're playing on, and it's more of like, hey, what can I play with my friends? That's much more important.
Yeah, Fortnite really opened the door for that. We have to give a lot of credit to Tim Sweeney, for the CEO of Epic Games, which makes Fortnite, for pulling the different platforms together and the consoles themselves, all three, in addition to that PC, in addition to that mobile. And then within mobile, you got both Android and iOS. And this is the first time we've seen all of this crossplay happen. And so that's a significant part of 2019. When we look back in history, we'll say, wow, that's when the barrier started coming down. And it really made a massive difference because for the first time, you could play with your buddy on an Xbox while you have a PlayStation. And we were never able to do that before. And it affected people's buying decisions or kept people out.
Yep.
And this just makes gaming completely completely universal, and it also, without it, you know, some people can't afford consoles or PCs, but they could still play with their buddies on their mobile devices. And so it made a huge difference, and we're starting to see a lot more games offer that. We're not totally there yet, but, you know, Rocket League, another one. There's some crossplay availability with a few other games. It's still, unfortunately, it's still early days, but we're seeing more and more of that happen. And I predict that over time, it'll be like that for almost every game.
Well, it certainly, you know, the reason, you know, part of the reason I bring this up is, you know, looking at the Google Stadia launch, that's definitely been part of their pitch, right? This idea that, you know, Google is on all these devices already, and that Stadia is their kind of, they're stepping into an environment where people have these expectations where they can play with friends on different places, they can take their games where they go. I'm curious what your thoughts on, like, the Google Stadia launch, how you feel like that's worked so far. It's early days yet, but...
Yeah, it is early. I think the proposition you described is a big part of what it's about, the fact that you don't have this cost barrier to get in. If you have a smart TV, you could just get a Chromecast Ultra to hook it up. You could play on phones, right now only Pixel phones, but that I imagine as over time could expand to other types. And of course, you can play on PCs and laptops. So the idea of that is pretty great. The problem that Google's had out of the gate is just the lack of games. It's just a very small library of games. I believe they've launched with about 22. And right. I do think over time they'll add more. But you know, it is challenging because it's a newcomer. People are very used to buying Microsoft's Xbox system or Sony's PlayStation or even Nintendo. So now we have a fourth alternative. And even though it is a lot less expensive at the get-go, you still, again, you have this problem of content. So I do believe that if Google is able to strike deals for more content and the latest and greatest games, it could certainly take off. But right now, it's not that way.
Yeah. I mean, one of the interesting things with Stadia, and, you know, I hope Google commits to it long term, is that they're trying to convince an audience of people who've traditionally thought of games as being powered by hardware as essentially like a software proposition. I mean, you think about some of these other Google products, say like Gmail, for example, which is in beta for a long period of time, or, you know, any of these other other things that are living systems. I do think that is an edge that Google has in terms of, you know, they are in the business of creating like living, breathing ecosystems. And a lot of video game companies, you know, even on the hardware side, they don't necessarily think about their product necessarily the, you know, the same way. So
the other thing is that we know Microsoft is doing xCloud, and so what you have to imagine is that next year Microsoft is coming out with a new console, so is Sony. Imagine, just hypothetically, and I don't know this, I'm not sharing any information that is, this is just pure, you know, hypothetical. But imagine you have the option of downloading games and or streaming them. So your console has only so much storage, right? So you download your favorite games or the ones that you, that really matter to you, that you can't imagine, you know, losing. You may even buy a hard copy of it too, whatever. But for any game, other games, you might want to stream them, especially when you're on the go and you don't have your hard drive with you, but you'd be able to stream them from a laptop or your phone while you're traveling for whatever reason. Then, you know, the Xbox, even though it's hundreds of dollars, may still be compelling to you. You're also more comfortable and you have the greater library. Yeah. So, part of it is a traditional brand thing. You know, you go to the supermarket, you see five different boxes of cereal. Four of them you've seen commercials for, one you've never heard of. You're kind of scared to try the one you've never heard of. It may be perfectly fine cereal, but you just, like, you've never seen the commercial. You don't know the character on there, and you're like, I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, Google is a name that people do know, but not when it comes to gaming, per se. And so it's a challenge for them to deal with that. So even if they get a bigger library, it can't just be a bigger library. I mean, you could add hundreds of games from years past, but you got to have the latest and greatest games, the ones that everybody is playing right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So until we see Call of Duty Modern Warfare pop up there, it's hard to imagine that it's going to scale, but we shall see.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about what the future might hold. Anything that you're looking forward to next year in 2020 that's exciting? Well, maybe not exciting is the right word, you know, using journalistic objectivity, but things that you think will be noteworthy in the upcoming year that you'll be keeping an eye on.
Well, certainly the launch of these new consoles. I'm curious to see what is going to make them the next step up, because these are, we're talking about our next generation. This is not just like a supposed to be a slight improvement.
Right.
This is supposed to be a significant upgrade. So the only thing I can fathom is this concept of having both streaming as well as downloading. I wonder if they're going to be disk drives. I suspect there may not be disk drives, which could be the final nail in the coffin for a company like GameStop. I'm just frankly curious to see how that rolls out and how people will react to it. It will also depend, like you said, if Stadia starts getting a lot more games and people getting more comfortable with the concept of streaming, and if the technology holds up when lots of people are doing it. So that remains to be seen. I think there's going to be this sort of hybrid period. I think it's going to take a while for streaming to become anywhere near mainstream. So having the hard box, the physical box, is still going to be important for a while. Unlike other forms of media, video games are interactive. And if you're playing competitively, even like the slightest delay is going to be a problem. And we know that online multiplayer gaming is very popular and competitive gaming is extremely popular right now. So at least in the near term, I can't see people giving up having dedicated LAN devices for gaming. I just think streaming will be more like an add-on or some sort of a bonus option that you would consider for certain situations when you're out of storage or when you're traveling. I don't think it'll end up being the primary way people game anytime soon. We haven't seen very much happen with augmented reality in gaming. It's sort of flat-footed. You know, will there be that game that like a Pokemon Go that gets us back into it? And then the other question, I'm still bullish on VR. I have a soft spot for virtual reality. I really enjoy playing it, but I do think it has a lot of challenges to go mainstream. But even if it doesn't, I still think it's really cool. So it may not be for everyone, but it is a really neat technology, and I can see it being applied even a lot more, even outside of gaming, to commercial uses, like, you know, with hospitals, with people practicing surgery through virtual reality, and firefighters practicing and how to put out fires, and with haptic gloves and haptic technology, the realism is pretty far out there. And so maybe we'll have, you know, I could see more of the malls where these experiences come into our virtual reality shop and take a trip to Hawaii. And they'll even, you know, they'll make the room really hot, or if you're in Alaska, they'll make it cold. I mean, I could see these more sort of experiences that take advantage of the technology but aren't necessarily something that everybody has at home.
Much like you, I'm also optimistic about VR, if only because I feel like we're finally getting a reset. And so I think the quality is getting to a place you can do a lot without having to be like tethered into a PC. And so I am optimistic. I think there's still a huge content problem there where, you know, it's very hard to build a business on VR at this point. So it's a chicken and egg thing. There's not yet a killer, sort of a killer app, although I guess Valve recently announced that they're making a new game in the Half-Life universe that will be for VR. So we'll see if that ends up being a, you know, something that kind of encourages people to get back in the race. But
I think the Half-Life argument is a weak one, unfortunately, because I think most of the people who are psyched for Half-Life probably already have a virtual reality system, because if you're into Half-Life, first of all, you've been playing games for quite some time.
Real quick aside here, Half-Life is a first-person shooter game developed by Valve. The last installment in the series was 13 years ago, and it ended on a cliffhanger. So yeah, fans of the game are excited for its comeback with a VR title in 2020. Now, back to our conversation.
I get the impression that Half-Life fans are mostly hardcore gamers. I could be wrong, but if that is the impression I'm under, and therefore I think a lot of hardcore gamers already have VR, or at least have made up their minds on it. Maybe if they were on the fence, now they'll finally go ahead and pull the plug and jump into VR. But I think what's interesting is we've seen some games like Superhot and I'm blanking on the other one that's sort of a dancey one that's on the talk show
Beat Saber.
Yeah, Beat Saber. That's been on the talk show circuit for a while now. It still hasn't been enough to make it go mainstream. I think the problem with virtual reality is that it's sort of lonely. Like, even though you can do it with other people and socialize in it, but when you're in it at home, you have your headset on, you're very, very immersed. Whereas now, if I play a game on my couch and my daughter walks in and says, "Mom, make me some chocolate milk," I could be like, "Oh, yeah," I can still see her and interact with her or whatever. But when you're in VR, it's like you're totally immersed in another world and you don't know what's going on. I mean, my house could be on fire. I have no idea, which is a scary thing. But that is part of the challenge. It's just like a very, I don't know, closed in experience. And it's great, but it's not for everybody. And so I absolutely love it, but I can understand why for other people it just doesn't jibe.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Look forward to your writing in the upcoming year.
All right, same. Thanks so much.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. This podcast is produced by Trisha Tonko with help from Anthony Martinez and music by Lucine. If you like the show, please share it with your friends and colleagues and leave us a rating on iTunes or wherever you listen. I'd also love to hear from you. You can find me, Jamin Warren, on Twitter at JAMINWAR. You can also find 256, that's spelled out, on Twitter at 256podcast.co, where you can sign up for our newsletter. Thanks so much and take care.